Welcome to Conversations on Healthcare with Mark Miceli and Margaret Flinter, a show where we speak to the top thought leaders in health innovation, health policy, care delivery, and the great minds who are shaping the healthcare of the future. This week, Mark and Margaret speak with Dr. Zeke Emanuel, Vice Provost for Global Initiatives and Chair of the Department of Medical Ethics at the University of Pennsylvania. A former advisor to the Office of Management and Budget, he advised the Obama administration on health reform. He talks about his latest book, Which Country Has the World's Best Healthcare, and how America is failing at containing the pandemic. Lori Robertson also checks in. The managing editor of FactCheck.org looks at misstatements spoken about health policy in the public domain, separating the fake from the facts. And we end with a bright idea that's improving health and well-being in everyday lives. If you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook, Twitter, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And you can also hear us by asking Alexa to play the program Conversations on Healthcare. Now, stay tuned for our interview with Dr. Zeke Emanuel here on Conversations on Healthcare.
We're speaking today with Dr. Zeke Emanuel, Vice Provost for Global Initiatives and Chair of the Department of Medical Ethics at the University of Pennsylvania. Dr. Emanuel is the founder of the Institute for Bioethics at the National Institute of Health.
A prolific writer, Dr. Emanuel has published over 300 peer-reviewed articles and 14 books, including his latest, Which Country Has the World's Best Healthcare? And previously, with this great title, Reinventing American Healthcare, How the Affordable Care Act Will Improve Our Terribly Complex, Blatantly Unjust, Outrageously Expensive, Error-Prone System. Dr. Emanuel, welcome back to Conversations on Healthcare.
It's wonderful to be here. Thank you for having me.
Well, it's great to see you. You know, you joined us last in 2013, which was a time of hope and transformation. It was in the midst of the health reform movement, which was fully underway. Now we are 7 years later and we're in the world pandemic, and it's really raging across a very divided America. Our death tolls are rising. We have a national government that really seems unwilling to adequately address the pandemic. I'm wondering if you could share with our listeners what your diagnosis of the problem we face is, and what's your prescription to get our country back to a safer space till we get to a vaccine?
It's really leadership. We have not had the leadership that we should in Washington. We needed leadership that would look at every component along the way: adequate PPE, adequate hospital beds, adequate ventilators, creating a vaccine, supply chains for testing, creating a army of contact tracers right now need to be getting ready for actually deploying, that is, distributing and administering vaccines. No preparation done. So, you know, we have had a lack of firm leadership. You know, the president has been obsessed by the economy, the stock index, but those are not going to respond well unless we actually have a response to COVID. I mean, people tell you in polling over and over again, and also by their behavior, yes, they're cooped up. Yes, the monotony is killing them. But they also are not going to fully engage in economic activity, sending their kids to school, going back to the office, unless they feel safe. And right now, it's hard to feel safe in almost every state in the country.
Well, Dr. Emanuel, we are concerned on so many fronts, and certainly one of them has been the administration's seeming attempts to discredit the nation's most highly regarded infectious disease experts like Dr. Fauci, who I know you've had a long relationship with. But more recently, is the White House shutting down the CDC's COVID-19 data collection infrastructure and funneling this critically important public health data kind of away from how it had been done and into a new and somewhat on the side way of doing it. Can you comment on that for us?
Yeah, I think they're trying to hide data they don't like. And I think it's terrible. You know, you cannot respond to a crisis without information. And they're trying to prevent people from getting good looks at how the pandemic is unfolding, who it's affecting, how many people are being hospitalized because of it, how much the hospitals are handling, how many people are actually dying, their race, their socioeconomic status. It is appalling. And it's so brazen that it's, you know, just unbelievable. It's certainly unethical, and it's also bad for actually responding to the country. What I really worry about is, say the President Trump loses and you have a new administration, you know, reconstituting all right. this infrastructure that's necessary right. to respond effectively is going to be very hard.
Absolutely.
And it'll take lots and lots of focus.
Well, let me pull the thread on that a little, because there's really no shortage of good information on how best to mitigate the spread of the virus. But the information seems to be undermined at every turn of the corner. In Georgia, for instance, the governor is actually suing municipalities that have issued universal mask orders for people congregating in public. And the misinformation campaign has added to really a lot of confusion. Thanks to you and your colleagues, you've created an easy to read guide I printed out for my family this weekend, showing the risk factors for engaging in certain behaviors. And I'm wondering if you could tell more about the COVID-19 risk index that you and your team have produced. I didn't see going to schools on that list, and your thoughts on that as well.
So first of all, on going to school, we have another risk index that we're going to bring out that's really school specific for exactly that reason. It was just too complicated, and there are too many variables about what schools need to adopt. But, you know, we want to get kids back in school, but that has to be done safely. Partially, you know, I just kept getting calls. You know, should I fly on a plane? What if I drive? You know, can we go to a restaurant? Getting all these questions. So we thought that it would be wise to create a risk index looking at various risk factors and put it on a scale from, you know, safe to very high risk. And it's a 5-point scale. We've used a number of criteria, 4 in particular. Does it occur in an enclosed space? Does it involve crowds of people that you can't really physically distance from? Does it have prolonged time? Are you there for an extended period of time, because we know that increases transmission? Mm-hmm. And does it involve forced exhalations, that is sneezing, coughing, yelling, or singing, that is likely to put a lot of virus into the air and therefore increase your risk of contracting it? And on the basis of those 4 things, you know, dining indoor restaurant compared to playing golf outdoors on an open course, yes, golf is going to be much safer than dining in an indoor restaurant. Mm-hmm. Working in an office is going to be less safe than walking out on a trail or playing tennis. And so that's the kind of metrics we use. You know, we're against singing in a choir. Bad idea, because people are constantly exhaling from deep inside. It's over a prolonged period of time. And you know, it's already been translated into Hindi, into Spanish, into French, into Portuguese, because I think the world, literally, not just the United States, the world is looking for this very clear information about how risky different activities are.
And I should know, my wife's chorus group is doing it by Zoom.
There you go. We recommend that.
So, Dr. Emanuel, you call yourself an optimistic person, but also a realist. And you recently wrote that your best guess for when we return to normal, allowing for such things as improved treatments, universal mask wearing, and a vaccine, is November 2021. And I'm going to repeat that, not November 2020, but November 2021. And that we could reach 250,000 Americans dead from COVID-19 before the end of this year. And what's going to need to happen to get us to what could even be considered something approaching normal life again?
Well, various parts of normal life are going to come back online at various points. But really getting to normal is going to require a vaccine that, call it, 70% of people have, and it's effective. If you just say, all right, December, January is the earliest we're going to get a vaccine that really people respond to, then, as I mentioned, you have to deploy it. You have to manufacture it. You have to put it in vials. You have to get it out to where you can administer it. You have to put it in people's arms. A lot of people are suspecting we're going to need 2 doses. So you put it in their arms one day and then the next day, and then they're going to have to build up antibodies. Just play it out. The first people to get it are healthcare workers, grocery workers, first responders like police. Then you're going to get high-risk people. Then you get out to us, average everyday people who aren't necessarily first responders. That's really going to, you're talking about the fall or the end of the year. That's how I came to November 21. You know, could it be January 2022? Okay. But it's in that range. It's not, as you say, before the end of 2020. And it's not even spring 2021, because we're talking about immunizing 250 million people twice. Just think of the logistics of that. got to give it to people. You've got to track people. You've got to figure out who's having an adverse reaction. That's a massive effort.
We're speaking today with Dr. Zeke Emanuel, Vice Provost for Global Initiatives and the Chair of the Department of Medical Ethics at the University of Pennsylvania. He served as an advisor to the Obama administration on crafting the Affordable Care Act. He's also author of hundreds of papers and 14 books, including his latest, Which Country Has the World's Best Healthcare? Dr. Emanuel, I really want to talk a little bit about the pillars of this global pandemic story. And America is the only industrialized nation in the world lacking some form of universal healthcare. And COVID-19 has clearly laid bare the gaping holes in our healthcare system. In your latest book, you examine countries that have far more efficient and effective and sometimes elegant health systems compared to the U.S. I wonder if you could share with our listeners what makes them work, how have those health systems contributed to their own COVID-19 outcomes, and what might we learn from them?
I have to say, you know, the response in this phase, which is really the acute phase still of COVID-19, is mostly about public health. Mm-hmm. It's about getting people to physically distance, to wear masks, to do hand hygiene. It's really not about the healthcare system. When they get sick, yes, they're in the healthcare system, but the adequacy of our response has not been about the healthcare system largely. It's been mostly about public health. And I think, as you point out, it's shown some of the great disparities and inefficiencies in the way we're organized, especially about collecting data and the coordination that the CDC can do. Having said that, you know, I think the standout country probably is Taiwan. They were close to China. They have a million people working in China. And yet they've had fewer than 500 cases and 7 deaths in the whole country. So how did they do it? Well, the first thing is they were suspicious of China because of SARS back in 2003, 2004. That led them to really prepare and to stockpile things like PPE. The second thing is they have a mask wearing culture. So unlike us, they don't have to push people to wear masks. People do wear masks because they think it will protect them from illnesses like COVID. And the third thing is they had this health card. So everybody in the country has a health card. When they go to the doctor, the card is swiped. The Ministry of Health knows why they're going to the doctor. It allowed them to rapidly identify people who had been to China so that those people could be tested for COVID and isolated. It also allowed them to identify people who had respiratory symptoms, cough, shortness of breath, other problems that would suggest that they might be at high risk for getting COVID, and they also could be tested for COVID. This allowed them to very rapidly identify at-risk people and test them and isolate them. And that's been a big plus. Germany, if you look at Germany, Germany has a lot of beds and a lot of ICUs compared to all other countries. They got, on a per-person basis, 40% more beds than the United States. So they were able to cope with the very big deluge. In Germany also, unlike the United States, they're more reluctant to intubate people than we are. And so we did a lot of intubation, and it turns out for COVID, intubation is not a good idea. And so they probably had a lower mortality rate because they didn't intubate people, and they had ICUs that allowed them to give patients more attention. There are many other things in Germany that worked well. The government jumped on it quickly, listened to the epidemiologists, right from the prime minister, who was, you know, really believes in expertise and really believes in execution, unlike our president, and the different styles are speak volumes. They've done way better than we have.
But Dr. Emanuel, you're among so many things, also a medical ethicist and a teacher training the next generation of clinicians. And wow, what a once in a lifetime seat that you wouldn't want to have for our next generation to have. And looking at this pandemic, they've seen people die in hallways while waiting to be seen in the emergency room. They've seen ICUs that are overcrowded while other hospitals have capacity. They see professional athletes getting daily COVID testing while just regular Joe Schmo might not be able to get a test at all. How is it seeing it through the eyes of this young next generation? What are they seeing, and how do you think they're being shaped by this for the future?
Well, I actually, very, very early on in, I think, March, I noted that this was very different than my experience growing up during the early HIV days. In the early HIV days, there was this huge debate, you know, should we treat HIV patients? Should we put ourselves at risk for treating the HIV patients? We had none of that debate. with this generation. This generation, it was quite clear we have an obligation to treat patients. We're going to treat patients. Yes, we're taking on some risk, but that is the price we pay for being doctors. And I just applauded them and thought how admirable. And I do think this, first of all, this obligation, this sense of duty, often the generations behind us get criticized as, you know, they're soft, they're not serious.
Yeah.
Quite the contrary. As you pointed out, their seriousness, their commitment, really admirable. And we should be taking lessons from that. Second, I would say that, you know, the disparities that they're seeing are something I think that is going to shape them. And I would not be surprised if this was a generation very much committed to issues of justice and getting it right. And I think that, you know, getting rid of the disparities that minorities or poor people get less good care, that they can't come into the hospital as frequently, I would think that they're going to be very committed to erasing those disparities. It does seem to offend them very deeply. I am worried about the gap between here and, you know, the fall, when we're going to have another uptick in the colder parts of the country. You know, I worry about burnout. And I think that's something else that this generation is going to have to deal with, the sort of intensity of the treatments and the issues. I would also say that I've written literally just before COVID came out in January, I wrote an article about moving a lot of medical education online, especially the preclinical years where you're learning anatomy and pathology. And I got a lot of pushback. And literally as if COVID came to just validate my perspective, because, you know, now Harvard Medical School, the first semester at least is totally online for next year. And I do think we're going to learn that, you know, we've got to rearrange medical school, the first preclinical stuff. We can do that online. We're going to have to fix how we're doing it.
Yeah.
And so I think that there's, in our near-term future, there's going to be a big shift in how we do medical education and what really a medical school is.
Well, there's a sliver of good news in this terrible pandemic. You know, I want to go back to those early days of the Affordable Care Act. And I think we heard from experts then. They told us that any big legislation like this is an iterative process. You know, when we passed Medicaid and Medicare, we knew it would require legislative changes, and there were dozens and dozens of changes made over the year in a bipartisan way. And the same held true for the ACA. It now seems like, and this may be too optimistic, there's some support across party lines to see continued reforms. And as you've noted in your book, we have a uniquely American challenge in fixing our healthcare system here. What do you believe the next phase of healthcare reform will look like post-election, post-pandemic? And I think it's fair to say the types of reforms might be dramatically different than the pre-COVID environment, with the embrace of telehealth, as you said, online learning, and other changes that have been done by, unfortunately, right now, only executive order.
No, I think you're 100% right. First of all, we've now seen an increase in the number of uninsured, 5.4 million in the last month, I think. And we're also seeing a lot of people lose their employer-sponsored insurance because they've been laid off. They're now going to be on Medicaid in the exchanges. And then the anticipation is that literally tens of millions of people who had employer-sponsored insurance are going to be on Medicaid. So you've got a very different situation going forward. I believe there is going to be big appetite to really reform the system. I just hope that the next president meets that national appetite for reforming the system. One of the things my brother and I put out there is we do not see how in the current system you can get to universal coverage given the intransigence of 14 states like Texas, like Florida, like North Carolina, like Georgia. So you're going to have to take Medicaid and make it a national program.
That's right.
And then I suggested that, you know, we can simplify everything by, you know, merging the exchanges, Medicaid and Medicare Advantage into one program. Because I think Medicare Advantage has been a hugely successful program, bipartisan. The seniors who are enrolled love it. And I think we can, it's already a kind of exchange. And I think we can simplify the system. You have employer-sponsored insurance, you're over 65, you have Medicare, and if not, you're in this Medicare Advantage exchange program, whether you're poor or not, you can get the universal coverage. You don't have insurance, we enroll you directly in that. And that simplification would also save a lot of money on administrative costs. Mm-hmm. And so I think that there's things like that. We also are just going to have to get our arms around the drug spending. It's a huge portion of our bill. We're looking at the hemophilia drug gene treatment that is about to be commercialized. It's in the approval process. $3 million per patient we're talking about. And we don't even know if it's lifetime. That just seems to me unconscionable and not something we can sustain for a long term. We're the only country that gives drug companies a monopoly and then lets them set their price. Every other country, I'm talking about Switzerland, I'm talking about Taiwan, I'm talking about lots of places committed to the free market, they regulate drug prices because you can't give someone a monopoly and expect them to price their commodity responsibly. So I think we're going to have to look at that as well.
We've been speaking today with Dr. Zeke Emanuel, Vice Provost for Global Initiatives and Chair of the Department of Medical Ethics at the University of Pennsylvania, and the author of the just-published book, Which Country Has the World's Best Healthcare? You can learn more about his important work by going to EzekielEmanuel.com or follow him on Twitter at Zeke Emanuel. Dr. Emanuel, we want to thank you so much for your enormous contributions to advancing and improving healthcare for all, for your dedication to public health and the society, and for joining us again on Conversations on Healthcare.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure and a great interview.
At Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lurie Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lurie, what have you got for us this week?
During a July 14 press conference from the White House, President Donald Trump made the outdated claim that U.S. deaths from COVID-19 are down tenfold. Data from three different sources show that, as of July 14, the total number and seven-day average of daily deaths from the disease caused by the coronavirus had declined between threefold and fourfold from its peak more than 2 months ago. Trump made the claim as he argued that news organizations have recently highlighted record increases in cases of the disease in several states. At one point, Trump's claim about a tenfold decrease was correct. The White House press secretary had used the same language in a July 6 press briefing, saying that deaths at the height of the coronavirus outbreak were at 2,500 per day, but on July 4th, there were 254 deaths. We found slightly different numbers. The data aggregation website Worldometer reports that there were 2,748 coronavirus-related deaths on April 21 at the peak and 265 deaths on July 4. That's also a tenfold decrease. However, daily deaths have increased in the days since, including in Arizona, California, Florida, South Carolina, and Texas, meaning Trump's tenfold talking point is stale. There also hasn't been a tenfold decline in the seven-day average of deaths, which accounts for fluctuations in daily totals over a full week. All three of those data sources show a decline of less than fourfold from the peak to July 14 in the seven-day average. He has simply ignored the increases in daily deaths that have occurred since July 4th. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lurie Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have FactCheck.org's Lurie Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare. Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives.
While the world grapples with a global pandemic, public health experts have been simultaneously battling another ongoing health threat. Mosquitoes are considered one of the deadliest animals on Earth, leading to hundreds of millions of illnesses and some 2.7 million deaths per year globally. And diseases such as malaria, dengue fever, and Zika are on the rise.
So there's this one mosquito called Aedes aegypti that transmits a range of different viruses to people. They include viruses like yellow fever, dengue fever, chikungunya, Zika, and the consequences can be very dire, from a loss of life through to crippling social and economic cost.
Dr. Scott O'Neill is the director of the World Mosquito Program, which has developed an innovative approach to eradicating the threat.
I was particularly interested in this bacterium called Wolbachia. This bacteria is present in up to 50% of insects naturally, but not this one mosquito that transmits all these viruses. When we put the bacterium into the mosquito, the viruses couldn't grow any longer in the mosquito. So we're seeding populations of mosquitoes with our own mosquitoes that contain Wolbachia. Once the mosquitoes have it, they're protected from being able to transmit viruses.
Dr. O'Neill's team released the genetically modified mosquitoes into a targeted area, and the results showed a dramatic reduction in human infections.
In northern Australia, we deployed the Wolbachia over quite large areas, and we've seen essentially a complete elimination, 96% reduction in dengue in those cities.
The World Mosquito Program is one of six finalists in the MacArthur Foundation's 100 and Change competition, which awards a $100 million grant to innovative public health interventions.
And we would hope within 10 years we could bring this intervention to 500 million people.
The World Mosquito Program, an effective, targeted, genetic engineering approach to eradicating the threat of deadly mosquito-borne pathogens, leading to a dramatic reduction in harm to public health. Now that's a bright idea.
You've been listening to Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare is recorded at WESU, at Wesleyan University, streaming live at chcradio.com, iTunes, or wherever you listen to podcasts. If you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We love hearing from you. The show is brought to you by the Community Health Center.